come up. This is our third panel. We'll be focusing on the issue of the role of health in the context of Cuba's foreign policy, both from the question of what is Cuba doing in terms of its foreign assistance with respect to health, but also the extent to which health plays a role in the formulation of a broader set of foreign policy discussions as well. We're fortunate to have two people who have done considerable amount of research on this particular topic, which sometimes is called health diplomacy, sometimes medical internationalism, global health, and we'll hear a number of different terms from them as well, but I think this will be a nice way to bring together some of the themes that we have focused on this morning in our discussion of the Cuban health system, and of course more recently with the discussion of the biotech sectors. Our first speaker will be Julie Feinsilver, who is a visiting researcher at Georgetown University. She has conducted research on Cuban medical diplomacy since 1979 and is the author of the book called Healing the Masses, Cuban Health Politics at Home and Abroad, which came out in 1993. More recently, she has been engaged in work through a number of international organizations working in Latin America, including the Pan American Health Organization and the Inter-American Development Bank, working on issues dealing with health sector reform, evaluation, country program coordination, public sector modernization, and management for results. And she continues to build on the work that she has done previously on Cuba by focusing in particular on issues related to biodiversity, biotechnology and sustainable development, and medical diplomacy. Our second speaker will be Professor John Kirk, from Dalhousie University in Canada. He has been the author of, or co-editor of, numerous books on Cuba, most recently Cuban Medical Internationalism, Origins, Evolution, and Goals. And I think some of you may have found some information about that he had kindly placed outside. There are a number of additional books focusing on Cuba's foreign policy, Cuba's struggle for development, transformation and struggle, Cuba faces the 1990s. So Professor Kirk has focused on a number of issues related to Cuba's outward look, Cuba's foreign perspective. And he is currently working on the lessons that can be derived from Cuba's medical internationalism as well. Our moderator is here, so I will ask him to come up and chair the session, but wanted to go ahead and turn the panel over to you.
Thank you very much, Catherine, and I'd like to thank CSIS for bringing this topic into the mainstream. It's usually a topic that's only discussed in Latin American studies meetings or Cuba meetings, so thank you for bringing it. Okay, you can read the structure of the presentation, but I want to tell you why you should care about medical diplomacy, whether it's done by Cuba or someone else. Right now, medical diplomacy is a hot topic. The United States military has been discussing this in their blogs on their websites for quite some time. It was part of the public diplomacy under the Bush administration, under the last administration. The USS Comfort, which you've seen took off for Haiti, is part of the Navy's medical diplomacy. And in fact, last year, the Navy changed their slogan to a force for global good, recognizing the importance of medical diplomacy. And for many, many years, writers have written about the importance of winning hearts and minds of people in other countries. The United States, whether we like it or not, is involved in nation building. So there are lessons that one can learn from this. Medical civilian activities have been a very important part of all of the different branches of services and have been an important part of USAID work as well. And I think that, you know, we'll learn from Cuba a few lessons, as the distinguished panelists before me have pointed out. Some of what I was going to say has been said by others, so I'll try to go through those things in a hurry. Okay. Medical diplomacy is a collaboration between countries to improve relations and at the same time to improve the health of the peoples receiving these services. So they produce health benefits and improve relations. Okay, why has Cuba conducted medical diplomacy? First and foremost, it is for humanitarian reasons. Medical diplomacy has been a cornerstone of Cuban foreign policy from the outset of the revolution. The first international medical brigade that Cuba sent abroad was in May 1960 to support Chile after a major earthquake. And the first long-term medical mission was in 1963 to Algeria. And that was where doctors went for a 14-month mission. 56 doctors went to Algeria. And then during the 60s, they did this quite continuously in Africa and in the 70s as well for humanitarian reasons, recognizing problems in these countries and that they could provide help, despite the fact that half of the doctors in Cuba emigrated right after the revolution. So they were left with only 3,000 out of 6,000 doctors. So first and foremost, humanitarian reasons. Then the Cubans have always said that they have a debt to humanity for the support that they got during their own revolution. There are geopolitical reasons, of course. I mean, Cuba lives in a hostile neighborhood. Its closest neighbor is a colossus to the north. They look for ways to build relationships, to win friends, create allies, while this wouldn't protect them physically necessarily, but certainly it would protect them in international fora. There are two last reasons, symbolic capital and material capital, arose later. They came as a result of the Cubans realizing the benefit of conducting medical diplomacy. The symbolic capital is prestige, influence, and, of course, goodwill. And this is something that, of course, if you provide medical aid to a country, you accumulate. And ultimately, this symbolic capital can be translated into material capital, that is, aid and trade and credit. Okay, the enabling factors have been well discussed by the previous panels, particularly the first panel discussing the political will and the vision to focus on health as a basic human right, the establishment of a free universal health care system, which is a credible model for others to follow. And I think that was well established. And the key indicators that are comparable to those of the developed countries, particularly the U.S., with which Cuba has consistently compared itself. Now, early on, Fidel was interested in health. He had been interested in health from childhood, even though he became a lawyer. And he surrounded himself with doctors in the revolution. There were a lot of people who had medical training who fought in the mountains with him and later became close allies, even if they didn't work in medicine. And Che Guevara was one of them. He didn't really care much about medicine once he got in. You know, he was working on many other issues. But he did have some influence, and there were doctors who graduated from medical school at that time who also believed in the mission of Fidel and his other colleagues at the time. In fact, Fidel was so concerned about health that he said that health of the individual was a metaphor for the health of the body politic. As a result, key health indicators became indicators of government efficacy. And that led to this enormous investment and preoccupation with health, both at home and abroad. The last enabling factor was that eventually the Cubans had produced so many doctors, and in the 1980s they purposely produced doctors for export. And Fidel said, around 1980, he said, look, we're going to produce another 10,000 doctors a year to begin to help countries elsewhere. Quickly mentioned the origins of medical diplomacy, but I want to point out one thing here. In 1978, Fidel said he wanted to make Cuba world medical power, and that was a competition. It was sort of a symbolic competition with the United States. Another important point was that in 1979, the number of civilian aid workers that Cuba had as part of the USSR, the Eastern European countries, and the Chinese countries conglomerate of aid workers abroad was 19.4%. they only had 2% of the population of that group, but they produce a disproportionate number of civilian aid workers. And, of course, compared to the United States as well, they had considerably more. Thank you. Okay. What I want to do is go over a typology of Cuban medical diplomacy initiatives. There are short-term and long-term initiatives. These overlap in many ways. There's some things that start out as short-term that may become long-term. But, for the sake of presentation, I've divided them perhaps a little arbitrarily. Cuba has been involved in disaster relief since 1960, as I mentioned. They've worked providing aid, to almost every country that has had a natural disaster and some of the man-made disasters. There were earthquakes in Chile, in Peru, Nicaragua, Mexico, Armenia, Iran, Algeria, Pakistan, Indonesia, Peru, China in 2008, Haiti right now, hurricanes in Honduras, Nicaragua, Haiti, Guatemala, and of course there was Katrina, and Cuba did offer to send aid, to send 1,000 or more doctors fully equipped and to provide medical supplies, but the Bush administration turned down the offer. But it must be noted that the offer was made. There were floods in Venezuela, Guyana, Bolivia, Mexico, tsunami in Indonesia, Sri Lanka, epidemics. There were dengue epidemics in El Salvador, Ecuador, Nicaragua, in Honduras, Brazil, and Sri Lanka, cholera epidemic in Peru, Chernobyl. And also there was a radiation-related accident in Brazil in the 90s. And the Cubans, with regard to Chernobyl, they've treated over 20,000 children with radiation-related illnesses. So they haven't missed an opportunity to provide disaster relief where at all possible. The donation of medicine, medical supplies, and equipment always accompanies these disaster relief missions, but also the Cubans have done this irrespective of whether there was a natural disaster or not. And, for example, in 1985, 87, 89, the Cubans built and donated, staffed, three pediatric intensive care units in Bolivia long before Evo Morales came in. Okay. And they, while they were constructing these intensive care units, they sent the Bolivian medical staff to Cuba and trained them. Then when the units were open, then they had Cuban medical professors there who staffed staff these units at the upper level, helped the Bolivians manage a change process to the new procedures, and trained on the job a number of Bolivian medical personnel. Latin American neighbors, both on the left and the right, have for many decades received free medical care in Cuba. And, of course, as someone mentioned earlier, there's Operation Miracle, which is a fairly new process under which Venezuela has provided financing for Cuba to establish what, so far, 92 ophthalmological centers in other countries, a large portion of them in Venezuela and in Bolivia, but also in other countries, including in Mali, to perform sight-saving surgery on indigent people from different countries. And almost every country in this hemisphere has sent people to Cuba or to one of these 92 places to have sight-saving surgery. And right now, as of October of last year, 1.6 million people had been operated in that. There's on-the-job training for healthcare professionals, which I mentioned, the case of Bolivia, but there are many others. I mean, almost everywhere the Cubans have been involved, they have provided on-the-job training, and this is starting with the early 1960s. They work in health system organization, administration, planning, and advisory services, sometimes sponsored by the Pan American Health Organization or the World Health Organization, sometimes just at the invitation of the government. And they do program design for human resource development and the provision of specific medical services. Long-term initiatives. The Cubans directly provide primary health care, and they also staff hospitals, and they've established health care facilities. And one of the important things is that they have established this comprehensive health program that was mentioned earlier. As of October 2009, under the comprehensive health program, which is now operating in 44 countries, over 153 million medical consultations have been conducted, over 47 million of which were house calls. And as someone asked earlier, do anyone remember what a house call is or even know? It's in the where the doctors go to the patient's homes. The Cuban doctors operated on about 3.5 million patients. They delivered over a million babies, and they applied almost 10 million doses of vaccines and saved close to 2 million lives in emergency medical treatment. Currently, there are 29,171 medical students who are being trained in their own countries by the Comprehensive Health Program medical brigades through what the Cubans call Universidad Virtual de Salud. It's a virtual medical school. Over 28,000 are in Venezuela, but the remaining 825 are in some countries in Africa and East Timor. So that's a way that the Cubans are able to extend their reach, lessen the cost of training. Not only do they send people to the ELAM, which was discussed by the first panel, to the medical school in Cuba, but also they have established this distance training model where the Cuban doctors who are working in the host countries are at the same time trained to be mentors and professors. The students watch the doctors. They help in very minor ways, kind of like an assistant. You know, and as their experience increases, they're able to perform a few more maybe nursing-like services and do epidemiological research, assist in community diagnostics or family diagnostics. But they also have classes with CDs, DVDs. They have online interaction with professors. And if they go into this program, they have to agree to have continuing education for life. They need to participate in this as lifelong learning. There's the provision of full scholarships, which have already been mentioned, and the scientific exchanges, which also have been mentioned. But in scientific exchanges, often the Cubans organize conferences, international scientific conferences, which are sponsored by international scientific associations, that is, say, the Latin American and Iberian Association for Neuroscience, or something sponsored by the Pan American Health Organization or other groups. And they've been very successful in that. I was going to talk a little about Haiti, but I think Haiti has been mostly discussed. The important thing is that this is an opportunity for the U.S. and the Cubans to collaborate in disaster management, mitigation, relief activities. And I would argue that while both groups of doctors and medical relief personnel are on the ground, there should be some effort on the part of the two governments to get these two groups to coordinate. And it's sort of a learning process where they get to know each other a little better, trust each other a little more, and perhaps could go even further and maybe turn Guantanamo Naval Base into a regional center for disaster preparedness training, mitigation training, reconstruction training, and treatment. And wouldn't that be nice? Could have it under the auspices of the Pan American Health Organization, but with the collaboration of these two groups. Beneficiary countries of Cuban medical diplomacy programs. There are 103 countries since 1961 that have received different types of medical diplomacy. There are millions of patients per year who are treated. There are tens of thousands or at least 10,000 students who receive medical training every year, and that number has increased recently. There are over 37,000 Cuban medical professionals providing services in 98 countries and 4 overseas territories as of October of 2009. Now, this slide shows you the beneficiaries only of the comprehensive health program. But as you'll see, it's being implemented in 44 countries in most regions of the world, except, of course, Western Europe and the United States, which, you know, you would expect. This is a model that is, in fact, adaptable. You can't adopt whole-scale anything from any country, but you can adapt a lot of features of the model and apply them, particularly in countries where they don't have well-developed private health sectors and private health insurance sectors. I want to mention a little about the cost and the risks for Cuba of conducting medical diplomacy because, of course, it's not cost and risk-free. Salaries are relatively low, so that's not a major cost for Cuba. But there is a problem of domestic discontent as a result of so many doctors going elsewhere. I mean, there's sort of a joke in Cuba, and someone says, hey, what's next? Oh, well, I'm going to Venezuela. So what? You're going on an internationalist mission? And he says, no, I'm going to see my family doctor. Because there's so many of them over there. And so, you know, the Cuban government has taken this to heart, and Raul has tried making adjustments, mandating adjustments in the system so that they can have better attention at home. But still, this is a problem. And when you have this disaffection at home, then there is, of course, the risk of delegitimization of the regime, because healthcare has been one of the basic pillars, and it's been the pride of the Cubans, both on the ground, the common people, whoever, as well as the leadership. And the last one is you know, the loss of investment if doctors defect. And in August of 2006, the United States established the Cuban Medical Professional Parole Program to entice Cuban doctors working in third countries to defect. Now, this is really morally untenable, but they're encouraged. They're given fast-track processing, but their credentials aren't immediately recognized, and they have to go through the same process that any foreign medical graduate would to pass the foreign medical graduate's exam. Benefits for Cuba, well, they win friends, but also make a few enemies. The friends, of course, are the governments and the people who have received this aid over time. Enemies. In some host countries, the doctors and the medical associations have protested. There have been strikes in some places. There have been other types of civic action. Bolivia, Venezuela, South Africa, and Trinidad and Tobago medical associations have protested against Cuban doctors. They're a threat to their livelihood. They're a threat to the way medicine is practiced, because they work 24/7, and they work in neighborhoods where the local doctors don't want to work. So they see them as a threat. The Cubans, of course, would argue that, well, no, we're going to these places that these guys don't serve, so we're no threat. You know, we're just covering the people you don't deal with. And also, you know, it's an escape valve for the underpaid and disgruntled doctors, because, as you know, in the tourism area, one can earn hard currency and earn considerably more than doctors who really have devoted their lives to the revolution and really care about their patients and who have studied hard and earn equivalent of $25 a month, which is really not very much. And, of course, the lure of what they can earn outside is quite impressive. Almost done. I'd say to quickly conclude, and I have a couple of more points to make, is that this has been a successful diplomatic strategy for Cuba. The symbolic capital they've gained through prestige, influence, goodwill has been translated into votes of the UN. For the last 17 consecutive years, the United States has been overwhelmingly defeated in its desire to maintain the Cuban embargo. Only Palau, the Marshall Islands, and Israel have supported the U.S. In this area, and so it's really not led to an isolation of Cuba. It's led to the isolation of the U.S. on this point, on the embargo. And as the point was made earlier, if you really want to change things in Cuba, let market forces reign, open things up, you know. things, you know, it's hard to withstand the change. Latin American leaders at the OAS meeting in Trinidad Tobago this last year, used the Cuban medical diplomacy program in their countries as one of the reasons that they tried to convince President Obama to lift the embargo. So, you know, it doesn't make sense. And President Obama, of course, said, you know, there's a lot we can learn from Cuba in this area. And that resulted in July 2009 OAS summit in Honduras voting to reinstate Cuba, although both Fidel and Raul said that, you know, they weren't really interested in belonging to that organization, and there were some conditions, but the vote was passed. Cuba's medical diplomacy has been seen as an aid multiplier by the United Nations organizations, various organizations, not just the World Health and the Pan-American Health Organization. This has led to contracts for them to provide services. And, and it's certainly symbolic of the prestige the Cuban health system has been able to garner. Material capital aid and trade. I think everyone knows about the medical, the doctors, the oil for doctors, or the service supply, that is doctors, teachers, and other professionals to Venezuela in return for aid, trade, credit, oil being one of the principal things. And data from Carmela Misalago indicates that Cuba export earnings for medical products and services through trade and credit with Venezuela in 2006 equaled $2.3 billion. It was greater than tourism, and at that time he said it was the only bright spot in the Cuban economy. In 2008, all of services to Venezuela equaled about $5.6 billion, and trade was $9.4 billion. Trade aid investments and subsidies, $9.4 billion. And Carmela didn't have the breakdown on that and how much of that was for medical services, but certainly a good part was. A new agreement was recently signed with Venezuela. It was only for $3.2 billion, and I'm not sure quite what that entailed. Time is out. One thing I just want to say is the future direction of Cuba's medical diplomacy. I said they're going to continue to do more of the same, but I think they're going to focus mostly on the further extension of their comprehensive health program. This is something that has the multiplier effect. It's something that's recognized by World Health and PAHO and funded by them, by South Africa for some of their neighbors. Further extension of the free medical training through the virtual medical school, because that is a lot easier. It's a lot less costly to provide, and the medical students are helping the Cuban service providers at the same time. And, of course, they'll continue with their disaster relief. Future prospects, I would say the extent of the program still depend heavily, you know, sheer numbers depend heavily on Hugo Chavez and Venezuela's domestic problems, both political and socioeconomic, as well as changing oil prices, make that still a little more difficult, as we saw that the most recent trade aid and investment agreement is for a little bit less than it was before, and it may be as a result of that. And therefore, the Cuban government has been diversifying their clients, and they've increased cooperation with China, with the oil-rich Middle Eastern countries, and with some of the middle-income countries. They're seen as this good investment by aid multiplier by UN agencies, so I think that helps. And they are decreasing costs through the use of virtual medical school. Thank you.
Dr. Feinsilver, thank you very much. We'll now turn to Professor John Kirk.
The trouble when you're the last speaker is that all these fantastic points you thought you were going to make have all been made. So I'm going to try and do a seamless transition and try to look at some of the things which I think need to perhaps be looked at a little bit differently, but also things that have not been mentioned. I took the time to put this green sheet together. Rather than talk about what Cuba is doing, I thought that you have the highlights here in the front. Any one of these would be an extraordinary event in themselves for a country of 11.2 million. In actual fact, if you look at all that they've put together, it is mind-boggling to see what Cuba has managed to do. Julie mentioned the lobbying of the leaders at the Trinidad and Tobago summit, and you can see President Obama at the very top talking about the impact that this had upon him, that he has somehow vaguely remembered hearing about the role of Cuban medical internationalism, but in fact, when he had prime minister after prime minister lobbying, I think he realized that this is bigger than he had anticipated. So I'd like to begin, before anything, with some shameless self-promotion. And I'm glad to do this because I don't make any money out of it, so I feel my conscience is salved. This is a book which I wrote with a guy called Mike Erisman at Indiana State University, Cuban Medical Internationalism, Origins, Evolution, and Goals. It came out about 4 months ago. All the royalties for this go to the MEDIC programs, which I think are absolutely fantastic. So I would encourage you, if you're interested in the topic and if you have access to a library budget, because it costs a fair amount of money, to order it. Again, bear in mind that the authors of this don't get any money. It goes to the reconstruction of the library at the medical school and the Isle of Youth off the south coast of Cuba. So it's definitely a useful cause. Catherine has brought together an amazing group of people for looking at three different aspects. I'm the least qualified medically on the panel. My daughter says I'm a doctor without patients. I'm not too sure whether patients is with an S or with a CE. What I want to talk about is medical internationalism. And where I differ from Julie is that I think that the diplomacy aspect of it, the pragmatism aspect of it, is being overplayed, whereas the humanitarian aspects have been underplayed. I was very fortunate in 1994 and then again in 1996 to spend a week with Fidel Castro. I was interpreting for the premier of the province of Nova Scotia where I live, and so I got to see Fidel Castro close up for 2 weeks. He had his interpreter, Juanita, and I was with the premier. The premier was a family doctor, and the obsession with public health that Castro has is noticeable. And so the seed for this became obvious at the time to me. I'd written and co-edited a number of books on Cuban diplomacy, and originally this book was going to be called Cuban Medical Diplomacy. But after 5 years of interviewing Cuban medical personnel, I reached the conclusion that they did not see it as diplomacy. For many, it was a means of making money, as Julie Slide indicated very clearly. But I think many of them saw it as a rite of passage. Many of them saw it as an extension of what they've learned from daycare, that the collective is more important than the individual. Many of them saw it as a means of doing what they had done as an intern. It was the obvious thing to do. And 22% of Cuba's doctors, 22%, are working abroad on internationalist missions. So I wanted to emphasize that the humanitarian aspects of this, the medical internationalism. And I also want to talk about what for the Cubans is also very important as well, cooperation. This is not aid. This is not some paternalistic first world handing down things to the third world. This is cooperación, colaboración. So I think that the Cubans have a very different aspect of that, which I think is worthwhile pointing out. I want to emphasize, because I think Julie did a very good job, but I want to give more examples. This is a long-standing project. It goes back to 1960, and it's interesting that the person who in 1963, when the first 1960 was a bit like the Haiti incident now. It was an attempt at dealing with an earthquake in Chile, with a government that was not at all friendly to Cuba. In 1963, Algeria was a major political risk for the Castro government. because the government of France with General Charles de Gaulle was one of the few allies that Castro had in 1963. And by supporting Algeria, he was risking losing political capital with the French government, but went ahead anyway. Machado Ventura, the current senior first vice president, was the person who led that delegation. He's a doctor, which is very interesting, important to point out. It's also important to point out that Cuba's current foreign minister was the guy who led the Cuban mission to help me.
Pakistan,
2005, which is very interesting. So if you think about, again, Fidel Castro surrounded himself with doctors. And I once asked him, why do you have so many doctors? He said, to be a doctor, you've got to be an ethical person. You've got to put the community before yourself. And that's why, and he named his ministers who were doctors. So I'd like to point out, emphasize the long-standing nature of this. The soft power argument's been put forward, and the benefits, which I think were well illustrated. It's estimated that probably about $3 to $4 billion a year comes from the export of medical goods and services to Venezuela. It's also important in terms of votes. I'm a Canadian, and we see ourselves as the Boy Scouts of the Western world. But in actual fact, when we joined the new UN Human Rights Council, we were supported by 130 nations, whereas Cuba was supported by 135, which is very, 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 for us, quite surprising. Cuba, as you know, was the leader elected twice to lead the 118-nation non-aligned movement, which is quite extraordinary. And as Julie mentioned, apart from Israel, the United States, and Palau, which is, I think is about the same population as George Washington University, the entire planet was against the U.S. Embargo. I think that it's important to bear in mind the genuine, deeply rooted concern which people have for the whole alma ata ethic that runs deep in the Cuban psyche, an awareness to turn the brain drain into a brain gain. A lamb, which we've heard talked about this morning, is a fabulous example of that. The new model of training doctors is also a very good example of that. The fact that public health access to medicine is a human right, as far as the Cubans are concerned, the most basic, the most important, the most fundamental human right, which I think is, I'm sure the people in Haiti would agree with that. The commitment to internationalism has been talked about, but I'd like to emphasize a bit further because the Henry Reeve Brigade is worth noting. Now, the Henry Reeve Brigade, formed in 2005 after President Bush preferred to put politics before saving human lives. 1,100 doctors, which was then increased to 1,586 doctors, 25 tons of medicine to 35 tons of medicine turned down by the Bush administration. The Cubans then formed the Henry Reeve Brigade. Now, Henry Reeve was a guy from Brooklyn who joined the Mambises fighting for the independence of Cuba and was killed by the Spanish in 1876. But the medical internationalism runs deep in Cuba. We talked about the Che Guevara, an Argentine physician. We talked about Soviet Union, Venezuela. The need to pass it forward, to pass it on, is very deeply rooted. ALBA and the countries, particularly in Bolivia, Ecuador, Nicaragua, are very good examples. But Cuba, and I think it's important to bear this in mind, has always given medical aid where it's needed, regardless of ideological definition of a country. The best example is Somoza's Nicaragua. You couldn't think of any more profound enemy of the Cuban government than Anastasio Somoza. The Bay of Pigs invasion left from Nicaraguan shores. He went out of his way to show that he was the Latin from Manhattan who was the U.S. proconsul in Central America. Yet, when there was an earthquake, the first people in were the Cubans and state. El Salvador, under the previous government, when there was a dengue outbreak, the Cubans were the first in. 1.2 million doses of meningitis vaccine were given to Uruguay when Uruguay had broken off relations with Cuba. So it's important to bear in mind that ideological definition has not always been the key factor. It's also important to bear in mind that throughout the Caribbean, Cuba has had an interest. And the Cuban Constitution, if you look at it, you will see, and I'm quoting from the Cuban Constitution, refers to the need for proletarian internationalism, fraternal friendship, help, cooperation, and solidarity with the peoples of the world, especially those of Latin America and the Caribbean. It's in the Constitution of Cuba. We have an obligation, believe the Cubans, to help the people of Latin America and the Caribbean. Now, I want to emphasize the humanitarian aspect because I think Julie did a very good job looking at the benefits that accrue. East Timor and Haiti are two good examples where very few benefits accrue. If you look at the cost-benefit analysis, East Timor obtained its independence in 2002 after 25 years of a horrible civil war and military occupation of Indonesia. An estimated 100 to 250,000 people were killed. The country was an absolute disaster. At a non-aligned movement in 2003, Cuban support was requested, specifically to Fidel Castro. That was 2003. As of December 2009, there are now 680 East Timorese students being trained as doctors in Havana and 190 being trained back in East Timor, Timor-Leste. And in addition, there are 300 Cuban medical personnel in East Timor. That's one vote at the UN General Assembly. The Prime Minister of East Timor went on record, and there was a handout that came, it's over there, from the Prime Minister's office saying that they had agreed with Cuba that they couldn't afford to pay anything. So Cuba was paying the wages for the physicians who were in East Timor. Haiti is perhaps the best example of this long-term vision of cooperación. 5 minutes, okay. It's important, as was pointed out, that since 1998, after Hurricane George destroyed Haiti and after Hurricane Mitch destroyed Guatemala and Honduras, that's when the Cubans became extraordinarily important. And Julie gave the figures, so I won't go into those. But it's important to bear in mind that over 6,000 Cuban medical staff have been on the ground in Haiti since 1998. Over 6,000. At the time of the earthquake, there were 344, according to the Cuban newspapers. They were serving an estimated 80% of the population, which is extraordinary, and working in all 10 states. They were joined then by specialists of the Henry Reeve Brigade and a number of students, Haitian students, fifth and sixth year students in Santiago, have come to Cuba. So it's important to bear in mind that the Cubans believe in sustainable public health, and that's what they've been doing in Central America since Hurricane Mitch. That's what they've been doing in Haiti, training hundreds of doctors to go back to serve underserved areas. At the same time, using the Cuban medical staff who were there as in the interim. Several things that could be done. I've got 3 minutes. Concluding thoughts. If you look on the back of this, there are several suggestions for medical collaboration between the United States and Cuba. I think the most important one, this is the most difficult one perhaps for U.S. policymakers, is to accept that the U.S. approach to Cuba for the past 50 years has been an unmitigated disaster. Regime change? What regime change? How has Cuba changed? So I think there's, and I apologize if this seems as imperial Canadian arrogance, but I think it's important to bear in mind that the whole universe is waiting for people in Washington to realize that 50 years of enmity has not worked. Let's turn the page. Let's look for a new strategy. Specifically, I think there are several things that could be done. The CSIS report... Do you have a copy of it with you? The one?
It's just online.
Okay. There's one. It talks. The CSIS did a series of workshops on Cuba, and one of the things that it mentioned was the idea of collaboration. I don't have it, but I think it's worthwhile reading. It's a very good report, and it makes the specific aspect. This is an Amnesty International report, the U.S. embargo against Cuba, its impact on economic and social rights, published in London in 2009. And I think that's worth looking at because it lists the medical products that cannot be imported or can be imported only at astronomical increase in costs and going through third and fourth and fifth countries and other things which are delayed. So a very logical thing, if should this be possible, is to stop the blockade and facilitate bilateral trade and medical goods and services should come into that. I think that, as I mentioned at the back of the green sheet, allow American students to go to Cuba. Let them learn. Why should they not be allowed to go? To me, it's a lack of a basic human right to say, you cannot go. Well, why can't you go? I think if I were American, I would be absolutely appalled at the fact that that would be taken away from me. And I think, finally, realize that what Cuba has done goes back decades and will continue. Pardon? Oh, that's the okay. Exhibit A, Your Honor. Cuba Outlook, Raul and Beyond. And it talks at the back about... Okay, there's a... well, you have to take my word for it. But anyway, it says... it says, the United States should consider embarking on a policy that seeks considerably closer engagement with Cuba. One area of possible cooperation, and Julie mentioned this, did a great job, would be natural disaster management, working with the Cuban government and others in the region to improve planning for and response to hurricanes and other natural disasters, an area where a large array of U.S. government resources can be brought to bear. Exactly right. You know, the Cubans, if you ever look at, if you've been in Cuba when a hurricane... comes, thanks, Bill. You'll realize the Cubans mobilize people. They've got it down to a fine art. Whereas you look at southern Florida and you see people, you know, it's a disaster area. Learn from the Cubans. They've got so much that they can possibly show. Final quotation. I did my PhD thesis on José Martí. I'm one of the few crazy people on the entire planet who read the 27 volumes of the Obras Completas José Martí. Not too sure why I did it, but I was young and foolish. Bottom line is, Martí said this, and Fidel Castro is a Martí fanatic. Patria es humanidad. Humanity is our homeland. The Cuban government believes that. I think that it is a filter through which all the pragmatic developments you see occur, but also the non-pragmatic, the ones for which there are no spin-off benefits. Haiti is a good example. East Timor is a good example. Gambia is a good example. These are countries with one vote in the UN, with limited amount of purchasing power, yet the Cubans deliver. Another thing of Martí, hacer es la mejor forma de decir. Doing is the best way of saying. And the Cubans do it in terms of medical internationalism. Gracias.
Thank you all. Thank you, Julie and John. My apologies for arriving late. I'd like to offer some comments really from the perspective of being an Africanist, but also from perspective of looking at U.S. policy with respect to global health and some of the ideas that you put forward about collaborations, because I think that's a very good way to sort of end this particular panel. There's a couple of things that jump out from your presentations. One is that, you know, the 50-year-long legacy and the degree to which the Cubans have successfully branded themselves as having these special core competencies that are respected and acknowledged as a currency of the country, and they've distinguished themselves in that way. The degree to which this has been personalized at the level of, and driven by Fidel Castro, and the degree to which it's dependent upon external financing. From my perspective, looking back, I was during the period of the sort of last convulsions of the Cold War in the 80s, when you had when I was involved in the end of the wars in Ethiopia and Angola, just as two instances. There, you had a vast, sustained Soviet commitment on security grounds, right, to both of those governments. And the twin component of that, one of the twin components of that, was a very heavy Cuban medical investment. So that You know, if you went to either of those countries in the late 80s, you'd run into lots of Cuban medical personnel and lots of Soviet military officers. It was franchised out so that the Cubans had troops on the ground as well in both countries, significant force commitments financed by the Soviets as a surrogate force level, because of the full deployment of Soviets at that scale would have been destabilizing and more difficult. So what happened when the Cuban troops were withdrawn and the Soviet and the from Angola and from Ethiopia, when you had the end of the wars in Ethiopia, Eritrea, at the turn of the decade, when you had the negotiated settlements in Angola, what happened with respect to the Cuban military investments was it disappeared. So you had upwards of 1,000 Cuban medical personnel basically accounting for the infrastructure in Angola, and you had similar numbers in Ethiopia, and they just disappeared. And it would be very interesting. You know, so you have to ask yourself the question, in the case of the Angolans, who were very wealthy country, they've now been 8 years out of war, if you go back to the death of Savimbi, which was in February of 2002, they've not opted to go back to renew that relationship. They've chosen other pathways to invest their dollars in terms of buying medical expertise, personnel, on both a philanthropic but also on a commercial and a geostrategic level. So I think that's a very important point, is that Africa experience has been significantly divergent from the Latin American experience. And in this phase in which Venezuela is the great financier, Venezuela's stakes in Africa are minimal. Their stakes are regional. So you're going to have your medical diplomacy skewed in that direction versus in the 70s and 80s when you had a Soviet partnership and you had very heavy footprints in the big flash zones in Africa, in which the Cubans were pulled in both in terms of medical and security. That doesn't mean that you won't find these odd situations today. If you go to Botswana, you'll find 100 Cuban doctors there. If you go to Ireland, you'll find 100 Swana doctors. You know, you've got the swap out. Your Swana doctors go to Western Europe, train, and then they generally, the pattern has been the very successful recruitment levels. So you'll find as many Swana doctors in Ireland as you'll find Cuban doctors in Botswana today, which is a somewhat paradoxical and embarrassing situation. I might add one other thing that's important with respect to what Cuba has contributed, which this is an anecdote that gets pulled up occasionally, but it's an important one. When Museveni, president of Uganda, when Museveni was deploying in the early 90s, or late 80s, early 90s, was deploying troops, his troops, to Havana for training, they were tested. He sent a contingent, I forget, a couple of hundred troops to get trained, and they were tested for HIV. And they hadn't been tested because the testing wasn't taking place in Uganda, and it showed very high prevalence rates. And Castro intervened and communicated this directly back to Museveni and said, "You've got a serious problem. 20% of your guys are HIV positive." That experience was really a change moment for Uganda. If you go back to what was it that ignited Museveni to become a leader on health, on HIV specifically, in Uganda, and to break out of the pack and lead the way, he will tell you that it was that experience. I mean, it was an accidental one, but it had deeper roots in what you said earlier, the passion that Fidel had, the attention to detail, the fact that if you were bringing troops in for training, you, by habit, you insisted that they be tested for HIV, and then you insisted that that data be communicated immediately and straight back to the head of state. And that is a very, very significant historical fact. Now, just quickly on two other things. China, we need to think about China. If you're looking at any Africa context today with respect to Cuban foreign Cuban medical diplomacy. You have to ask who might pay the bills. You have to ask how does this stack up against what the U.S. is doing. I'll say more about that in a minute. And you have to ask yourself how might that stack up against what the Chinese do, because the Chinese have had 1,000 docks on the ground in 36 countries in Africa for 40 years as well, and they're on a roar right now. And they're revisiting and renewing that program and expanding it, and their training and exchange programs are, you know, have been going like this for this entire past decade. So the Cubans, unless they hook themselves in some fashion to that, they're going to be outcompeted in almost all African countries where the Chinese are playing, and the Chinese are playing pretty universally in Africa. In the U.S. side, if you look at the dollars expended, I mean, we're now looking at expenditures in Africa of well over $7 billion a year in medical, you know, in global health programming. If you go back to the advent of PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan, which was launched in 2003, we've spent well over $25 billion globally, and over 70% of that has gone into Africa. So we have a pretty big footprint. We're now talking about going into maternal child health and family planning in a big way. And we heard earlier this morning about the kind of models that have been developed on what the maternity homes and the other models that we heard about. But there's been, as best I can tell, there's been very little dialogue, cross-dialogue, between the United States and Cuba. It's been much more of a competitive or an antithetical kind of relationship with respect to health as it is on most other dimensions. And I liked your point, both of you, arguing that it's time to sort of take another look, to pause and look back and see if this is one avenue where you can have dialogue and enlarge. I don't think you're going to have a transformation of the U.S.-Cuban bilateral relationship, but what you can have is an incremental transformation that advances over time in putting U.S. and Cuba into certain channels where there are pragmatic mutual gains that can be achieved. And in this case of medical diplomacy and programmatic collaborations, you have multilateral opportunities through PAHO, through WHO. You have points. If you decided you wanted to push this forward, you can do bilateral. You can be country-based. You can look at multilateral institutions. And, you know, this gets to one other point. The Cubans have branded themselves as having exceptional capacities on emergency response. And in Haiti, we're seeing that. The United States is the best in the world on that, on both the military and the civil side. And today in Haiti, you have side-by-side large contingents of all of those, right? And you're having a call by people like Paul Farmer, the deputy UN envoy, for, okay, how do these pieces get knit together into some coordinated entity? So, you know, you have an immediate opportunity today for cross-dialogue if there were a will to do that, because you have immediate imperatives to coordinate activities and make sure you're not duplicating and that there's sharing of information and the like. And both governments do this very well. And both are committed for their own national reasons for responding to this tragedy. So I've hit most of my points, and thank you for indulging me. And maybe I can ask you just to respond a bit, and then let's open the floor and use the balance of our time.
I think since I had the opportunity to speak first, I'll let John go first this time.
You can just
push this. Okay.
Points are very hard.
Push that. Push this button.
This one?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Some very interesting points. Cuba's got, according to the most recent stats, in sub-Saharan Africa, 1,117 collaborators in 23 countries, about the same as the Chinese. Yeah. And the Chinese are looking for minerals anywhere they can find them. So I agree with you that they are major source of competition. One of the things I think that your argument would gain from by emphasizing the fact that in 2001 the Cuban government for the first time, and then 2005 offered to work with the U.S. and work with the industrialized world in dealing with HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. They would put 5,000 medical personnel, and so far the silence from the developed world is incredibly silent. So I think that there's tremendous potential for collaboration. The planet needs collaboration, and to have the U.S. Grab that net, the nettle, and do that would be an extraordinary thing. France, Canada, in the past, Japan have helped in trilateral health exploration projects, and I think that it's important for the developed world to stand up. One of the things I'd like to emphasize in terms of any sort of emergency response collaboration program is the need for a sustainable health public health program, and I think that if you look at some of the aspects of what U.S. Emergency response has been terrific for the first 3 and 6 and in some cases 9 months. But when Dr. Sanjay Gupta leaves and when the USNS Comfort leaves, the Cubans are still going to be in Haiti the way they have been since 1998. So I'd like to emphasize the need for a sustainable form of cooperation and not just throwing money at a problem or not just thinking that the problem can be served by having a sort of a blitz. It has to be sustainable. It has to be developed. And I think that your point is valid because, as we saw in Venezuela in, I think it was 1999, the mudslides, as we saw in Honduras with Hurricane Mitch in Guatemala, Cuban doctors worked alongside U.S. military forces. It can be done. It should be done. It's common sense. But I think that there has to be also, in terms of confidence building, some indication from Washington that this is desirable and this is okay to do, as opposed to doing it flying by the seat of your pants. And I'm not too sure that, yes, those guidelines have been given.
Well, I think John's response is very difficult to add to, but this is an excellent response. I guess I'd like to say that with regard to the type of aid that Cuba can give, it's not only that it is very good at low-tech medicine and working in these developing and devastated countries, which U.S. is not really as good at, but also they're very good at, as John points out, the need for this long-term development of a sustainable healthcare system. And this is what they can do and have been doing with their comprehensive health program, which is implemented in 44 countries. You know, you can't adapt to whole scale, but in the Cuban model, but there's a lot that can be done to make systems in these poorer countries feasible. So I agree that that right now in Haiti, what we need is what Paul Farmer said has to be translated to what President Obama says, and the Joint Chiefs work together.
Yeah, let me add a couple points. One is, you turn this around and you can say if the Cubans want their medical diplomacy to be a sort of broadly accepted currency that has sustainability to it, finding some way to wiggle free of the reputational risks of Venezuela is it very advisable? Because twinning yourself with Hugo Chavez doesn't get you very far in most capitals, and it certainly doesn't get you anywhere in this capital or on Capitol Hill, even among friends of Cuba. So that's a problem that is a Cuban problem. It's not an American problem. On the question of sustainability of response, if you go back to Mitch in 98, if you flash forward to Haiti today, the comfort, large military hospital, which the comfort is, which is based out of Baltimore, which started operations, but we heard from Ellen yesterday, is that right? Yesterday or today? The big story in terms of U.S. response in Haiti was the Southern Command. The big story in Mitch was the Southern Command. That is, moving into place the sea power and the air power and the lift and the ability to restore airport terminals, ports, coordinate traffic in and out, and use the special lift capacities to get emergency food, water, and personnel in place. And that's the big show. The Cuban contribution is not to be underestimated, but it's a tiny fraction against the U.S. military contribution in that setting. And it's by definition, the military response is short-term. And a handoff happens very rapidly to the civilian side of things. And there, again, for the U.S. policy question is there the will to sustain it and convert to the kind of reconstruction, civilian-led reconstruction? U.S. bilateral assistance to Haiti is running at about a little under $400 million per year before the earthquake. And the debate, the deliberations now are with, between Congress and the appropriators on the Hill are very early in terms of what type, there are various numbers getting thrown around, 5-year, $30 billion. But there are numbers getting thrown around which are significant magnitudes of order higher than $400 million. But $400 million a year is not chicken scratch in U.S. foreign aid terms. Mm-hmm. And it certainly dwarfs Cuban foreign aid to Haiti. So let's put all this in perspective. The military response on the emergency side is vast and is the big game. The civilian side, U.S. bilateral civilian assistance, long-term assistance, is the big game. And the Cubans are important. And there's very little cross-fertilization across those universes. And if you could remove the Chavez piece of this, you might get a lot farther in trying to find the ways you could knit programs together. Why don't we invite, yes?
A couple of points just to follow up on what you're saying, Stephen. Anyone who's familiar with Paul Farmer's work will know that his comments that he made recently about the need to coordinate a little more on the ground actually probably come from a general critique he would make about the way that international global health operates. And I think this is, in a way, almost where the burden of proof ought to lie, because you mentioned PEPFAR. Nobody can criticize the amount of money that PEPFAR has channeled into a lot of countries, specifically in terms of AIDS programs and boosting provision to antiretrovirals. But there are critiques about the way in which that money gets spent on the ground, and more particularly, and here I think is where it cuts into the Cuban issue, whether that aid is used to buy in local or Western organizations who will deliver the deliver the drugs, or whether it's going into local health development. Mm. And I think the Cuban model, in a way, because of its long-termism, does produce and develop, in the same way that MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, in the way that they will spend a long period of time in a country separate to disaster management, build up health systems. And building up health systems is a great way to develop more generally.
Yeah. I think on that point, though, you'd need to ask yourself if you say the Cuban program has greater sustainability and impacts on local capacity, it would be very interesting if there were a survey around that question in some of the key African countries where those 1,100, the 1,100 personnel spread over 23 countries. That's pretty modest, and that's pretty marginal. And so lasting systems impacts in Africa by Cuba are negligible.
Yeah.
I wouldn't draw quite the same comparison as saying we've spent $25 billion, what have the system impacts been? There is a debate that's going on right now and has been for some time in Washington around changing the way we do our practices for the reasons that you just outlined. But I think we have to be fair about looking at what in the African context, what have the real impacts been of the Cuban, to say that it's had a sustainable long-term impact, I think is debatable.
But I think in a way one of the things you want to do is to have that, because, the politics of this is always going to be very difficult, and you mentioned that in terms of the extent to which Cuba may or may not align itself with Chavez. I think what you need is concrete, small-term concrete areas in which you can develop collaboration. Re-establishing postal links, that was quite good in that sense because it's something you can do. Right. And the same isn't true, the collaboration is not so much in terms of Cuba-US disaster management relief. It's about what the U.S. may learn from Cuba and vice versa in terms of, you know, longer-term aid and health programs.
Right.
So I think, you know, my idea is in a way to sort of just shift attention. I know Haiti is relevant and so forth at the moment, but not to focus the debate in around disaster management. Because I think the most productive collaboration will come from a more generalized discussion.
Mm-hmm. That was a very good point.
Can I add a few comments on what we've last 15 minutes of debate? Because I think it typifies a real problem that we have in talking about Cuba, certainly in this country, maybe not elsewhere, because there is such a danger, as we have possibly heard, of polarizing the debate between the Cubanists, many of us in this room, and those who have, understandably and rightly, a question mark over whether many of the claims that are made for Cuba are real or indeed, as we've just heard, sustainable. It's for that very reason that a number of us launched the Institute for the Study of Cuba in London 3 years ago, because we felt that what was required in this debate was bringing the academic rigor of objective study of both the claims and counterclaims. Because what you tend to find in the literature are either pro-Cuban celebrations of the Cuban story or anti-Cuban invective that takes us no further forward. I think we've heard today, over this last 5 minutes, a challenge, which I think is a fair challenge. What have the Cubans done in Africa? Have we got objective research studies to actually be clear that their impact is what they claim it to be? We have not. And if I have a quarrel with my Cuban academic colleagues, is that they have found it very difficult to allow non-Cubans to do the academic research that I, as an academic, would see as being valid and valuable. And so I think the Cubans do have to accept that outsiders like ourselves should be allowed to evaluate their programs in Africa in the way that academic do, because otherwise we will continually have this debate about the claims. And it is that next step which I personally believe has to occur if we're going to get beyond the pro and the anti. Thank you.
Might I add a comment as
please,
well?
Please.
I can't be as erudite as that statement was, but I just wanted to emphasize an issue that has been mentioned, I think, but not emphasized by others, and that is the quality of the intervention and the size of the country involved and the nature of the relationship between the Cuban government and the government to whom they're providing services. A key to that, I think, is that when Cuba goes to another country, they do so with an agreement with that country's government. Their aid is not necessarily disease-specific aid or spent outside of the governmental agency, just the opposite. And so much of what comes from the private sector and to some degree the public sector in the well-to-do countries in the world focuses on a particular disease or entity, sets up its own infrastructure, actually draws personnel away from the country's infrastructure because they generally pay better, and essentially undermine the governmental agencies responsible for public health in the host country. So I think one of the Cuban lessons that's important is that if you're going to have a long-lasting, sustainable is the word, impact, one of the underlying principles needs to be that whatever you do, you have to shore up that country's public health system to the degree that it can eventually attract, train, and deploy the expertise it needs in order to make a difference on the ground. So it's not so much how many dollars go in.
All right.
It's sort of how they go in, how they're spent, and then what what indeed their intent is and what the long-term impact is likely to be.
Right.
So it's the government-to-government collaboration and the understanding that if we're going to have long-term success, we have to build up that country's infrastructure, not do something in spite of it or around of it or actually that tears it.
Right. Well, I would agree with you. I would suggest, you know, right now the Obama administration is putting the details together on implementation of their follow-on to PEPFAR, which is the Global Health Initiative, which is a six-year, $63 billion program. And this theme about getting into government-to-government, making the government-to-government relationship a central facet and building up ownership and capacity within those ministries, health, finance, president's office, the commitments on the budget, personnel and the like, over the long term as a key point of our as a key objective, rather than not to displace the delivery of key services on treatment and prevention and the like on across a span of things. That's now emerging, and the question is, how do you go about doing that? So that is very much in the air, and it's something that you're not going to have an argument, I don't think, from the experts. There's been a significant shift. There's been a significant shift among policymakers, and the Kaiser Family Foundation most recent survey of American opinion shows a very significant shift in favor of investment in health systems by the American people. And that's a big change. The other thing I'd say is we're already doing a significant chunk of that in terms of U.S. policy. If you go to Ethiopia today, it's one of our biggest partners in Africa. We are spending $400 million this year in health, setting aside the $500 or $600 million in humanitarian emergency relief and the other development programs. We're spending $400 million this year on health. $100 million or more of that is a direct program of CDC to the Ministry of Health in building its capacity. Okay, so there is a direct, and we've been doing that for 6 years. Okay, this is not new. And if you look at the other portions of that program, there's a lot of NGO implementers, but they're working, they're under enormous pressure to make sure they're leaving behind capacity and that there's a transition and handoff. And so, you know, when you look at the 30,000 community health workers who've been deployed and trained and deployed, much like Cuba, in community health work, six-month training courses deployed into almost all women, a pair to each village, 30,000 to 15,000 villages, very Cuban in its logic. Who is the major funder of that program? United States, not Cuba. So there is a, you know, there, I don't think there's a... Yes, please.
Thank you. I think in as much as I understand the importance of measuring impacts in terms of how Cuba... or how far Cuba has gone assisting a sub-Saharan African or sub-Saharan African countries. I come from South Africa. I'm health attaché here in Washington, D.C. I think we need to consider also issues of scale in terms of where those countries find themselves before the inputs from Cuba. Thinking, for instance, about where we find ourselves about in disintegrated, centralized health system pre the interventions of the new, of since 1994. And the work that has been done by Cuba assisting South Africa to get to some point is we can't ignore that. It's substantial in our view. We just need many Cuban approaches to the problem in terms of scale and intensifying that kind of approach. So whether we can just say then in terms of impacts, there's nothing much that has been done by the input and assistance from Cuba wouldn't be fair to that collaboration. I think that we need to consider issues of scale and the extent of problems in countries as they interact. We just need many Cuban approaches to it. Thank you.
Please, Julie.
I just want to say something very quickly. I really appreciate your remark about the impact of Cuban assistance because, you know, it's not a matter, I think, as was said before, it's not a matter of money. It's not even a matter of how many boots you have on the ground or stethoscopes you have on the ground. The Cuban assistance has often been in helping plan system change. You know, help advising ministries. You don't need, you know, 30,000 people to do that, or even 10,000 or 1,000. You know, you have a handful of specialists who help the different ministries in both Africa and in Latin America and the Caribbean change the way they're doing business to make it more sustainable.
Where have we seen that impact, the greatest impact on the systems design, the sort of taking their the Cuban success experience?
Can I reply to that?
Well, if you want to. Okay.
Where do you see the sort of intellectual and planning expertise translating into impacts?
Okay. Cuba set up medical schools in Yemen, 76, Guyana, 84, Ethiopia, 84, Uganda, 86, Ghana, 1991, Equatorial Guinea, 2000, Haiti, 2001, Guinea-Bissau, 2004, as well as East Timor and Venezuela. In terms of the impact, because I think the quote was, the role in Africa is debatable. In actual fact, if you look at two countries, the Gambia and Ghana, I just done an article comparing what happened. In Ghana, increase in the vaccination rate, this is between 1990 and 2005, the increase in vaccination rate of 61% to 86%. The average doctor-to-patient ratio in Ghana went from one physician for every 16,660 people to one for every 6,060. If you look at Gambia...
And you're attributing those gains to Cuban assistance?
I'm attributing, yes, to a logic then, yeah, because a medical school was set up to train doctors precisely to choose people who, in the case of Elam, who would not flee to Ireland to make the bucks, but in fact would stay in Gambia. So you select people from poor backgrounds so that they will go back once they've been trained in a Cuban-established, staffed medical university to work with underserved populations. Mm-hmm. A better example is Gambia. If you look again, again from the research that I've just finished, 1998, the doctor-to-patient ratio went from 21 doctor for every 21,000 people to one for 9,714. In terms of cases of malaria, again, the Cubans have set up a malaria research center at the request of the government of Gambia. And again, this is at the government's got to make the request to the Cubans, and the Cubans respond to it. East Timor is the most recent example. And in case of the cases, the recorded cases of malaria plunged from 600,000 in 2002 to 200,000 in 2004. And I presume will continue. So I think that to say that the role in Africa is debatable is wrong. I think that if you look at the very first vaccination campaign that took place in Africa, it was introduced by Che Guevara in the Congo. I think the Cubans, what you mentioned, Hugo Chavez before, when Hugo Chavez was 5 years of age, the Cubans had been involved in Chile and had been involved in Algeria. So I think that medical internationalism has deep, deep roots with or without Hugo Chavez, was there before Hugo Chavez appeared on the scene, will continue. And I think that the you're wrong to say that the impact is debatable. I think the Cubans, there are 400, we think, doctors in South Africa. Maybe our colleague can help us. I'm sure if you look at what the Cubans are doing in South Africa, it would be a terrific study. I'd love to go to South Africa during the World Cup. If someone wants to pay me to go, I'd be delighted.
Me too.
Well, the attaché is organizing a contingent to the World Cup, so we can talk to her. We're getting towards the end of the hour. Can I ask you to make the last comment, and then we'll close?
I just have one sort of brief question for both Julie and John, and this is stepping back just a little bit, because so many of us study Cubans and Cuban attitudes and Cuba in an anthropological or individual way, either vocationally or avocationally. And I'm wondering, what is it about, if we turn the lens of study on our own self and our own society, what is it about our individualistic society, which is basically proud and on a person-to-person basis, generally very good-hearted, but what is it about our position that makes it so difficult, makes us so suspicious of altruistic motives and humanitarian motives in someone else?
I'm going to pass that to John.
Don't, please don't. Would someone like to share an opinion as to why our societies don't believe in altruism? Or should we leave it hanging for us to...
Well, I don't, you know, I beg to differ. I mean, look at the response of the Cubans and the Americans to Haiti. That wasn't a cynical response. This administration and the government in Cuba responded remarkably well and fast and mobilized vast numbers of its citizenry and had enormous support from their societies, both of them. And both of them have been at their best moments in the last week. So I don't think there's cynicism. I think you have to have a realism and a tough-mindedness about if you're going to try to get U.S. and Cuba collaborating on health matters, there's going to be a broader set of poisons in the water around the bilateral legacy, right? And so having an embrace on medical matters with Hugo Chavez is a problem, whether you love Hugo or not. So, you know... I mean, it's from a political standpoint. If you are trying to argue that this administration should step out and embrace the Cubans on collaborations in health, I think that's a smart strategy. But you're going to have to fix the Hugo Chavez dimension of this, because right now it's a competitive form of medical diplomacy, right? It's a competitive form of seeking political influence through those programs.
Stephen, maybe after the U.S. takes Cuba off the list of 14 countries to foment terrorism, maybe that could be...
Well, there's lots of fault and complications and ill-advised policies, and I agree with you that, you know, certainly many, many people in this room and in this town have spent years, poring over this issue of how the hell to get out from underneath this legacy.
Right.
And having all of you say that again to us is just another reminder. So, I'm told we need to end our discussion here. Some of us will be together for lunch, and we can carry this on. I want to thank John and Julie for your contributions, and I want to thank my colleagues Catherine Bliss and others for putting a wonderful day together. It's been a great, rich learning experience, and thank you all for being with us.